Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 389, we bring you the preview of the May 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician is published in print as well as available for free online at retinalphysician.com. Doctors Rebecca Suarez and Akshay Thomas join me for this episode, and we cover a number of topics. We start with discussing whether ultra-wide-field imaging in undilated patients can replace a dilated fundus exam, controversial and interesting topic. Then we talk about home monitoring for wet AMD conversion, followed by discussion of big data analytics in retina and retina practice, and end with the discussion of stem cell therapy for retinal diseases. Remember, all these articles can be found for free online. You can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. Remember, you can claim CME for prior episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the May 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, you can find Retinal Physician online at retinalphysician.com. And joining me for this episode, I have two colleagues in the field of retina. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Rebecca Ross Suarez, who is in Boston. Rebecca, thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Akshay Thomas, who is in Nashville, not Memphis, Tennessee.
Thanks for having me, Akshay.
All right. I've got it down. I think I three times in a row I've gotten it right, so we're good. We'll jump right into this. Remember, if you want to read these articles, they are available for free online at retinalphysician.com. We are not going to recap every part of these articles, but use them as kind of jumping off points for discussion. So the first article I'll talk about is called Replacing the Dilated Fundus Exam with Ultra-Wide-Field Imaging in Asymptomatic Patients, with the subtitle Imaging Without Dilation May Be the Future in Select Patients, by Angela Lee and Sharon Feckert from Duke University. And again, as a recap, they go through the fact that ultra-wide-field imaging can get a significant capture of the retinal periphery. You know, you're getting up to really 220 degrees field of view, which is what they, you know, anatomically is up to 80% of the retina. There isn't a fundus camera that gets everything, what we call a pan-retinal image capture, but it may be, you know, with multiple wide-field images, you can get out essentially to near 100%. And they talk about the different imaging systems that are available. But going to kind of the take-home point, I think the big take-home point they have is, could ultra-wide-field imaging ultimately be a substitute for the dilated fundus exam? And they have some citations. They talk about in diabetic retinopathy screening, there's one study that showed that an optose was equivalent and comparable to a standard DFE. And this was in non-dilated patients. And then they also talk about another diabetic study that also showed something similar. They looked at DFEs in asymptomatic patients after cataract surgery, and they looked at non-midriatic versus midriatic exams, either with the 90 doctor or Goldman 3 mirror, which very few people are doing now, and showed that there was good consistency between the slit lamp exam and ultra-wide-field exam. And that study argued that ultra-wide-field imaging could be a screening tool for patients after cataract surgery. And so they go through, and there's a couple other studies, including one from Japan, that they talk about. And then they talk about some of the limitations. Of course, the color artifact we can get into a little bit. We can talk about some of the things that can be missed depending on where the lashes are, especially superiorly and inferiorly. And then maybe for higher risk patients, ultra-wide field imaging may miss more things. Makes sense. If the incidence of a problem is higher, then you start to miss more of those things. But again, big take home from this is that this may be the future. There are limitations right now with the current technology, but ultimately down the line, it may be that the typical retina clinic flow, at least for screening of normal patients or asymptomatic patients, may be not in building in that dilation time, and that's more convenient for patients to go around their day after a visit. Also more convenient for flow, since you can just simply have the patient seen immediately after being worked up. So Rebecca, I'll let you kick this off. Obviously a very catchy title. This is a topic that I think divides retina specialists versus other anterior segment specialists, because I think there already is a bit of this going on in both the anterior segment ophthalmology world and optometry world. But your takeaways and your thoughts on this article?
I think ultra wide field imaging is a really potent tool for very specific, very select cases. I think primarily it's very good for screening amongst, you know, primary care physicians or other, as you mentioned, inter-segment physicians. And I think it also can be incredibly useful in the retina clinic if you're looking at monitoring a certain condition. I think that is an incredibly helpful tool. There's so many times where, you know, a few of my offices have Optos and a few actually do not. And so there's a, you know, I'll often bring those patients to my offices with Optos if I have something that I really want to kind of take a look at from time to time. Things like ARN, for example, where it's really important to know whether or not they're improving or if a cotton wool spot is getting bigger, sort of thing. And then I also think the other subgroup of patients I think it's helpful for are pediatric patients, actually. I think it can be an incredibly useful full tool, just given the challenges with the pediatric exam in general. But I definitely do not think it replaces the routine dilated exam by a retina specialist. I think if a patient is at a retina clinic, is in your chair, they are there for a full exam by a retina physician, and I don't think that the Optos yet replaces that.
Akshay, do you concur?
So I'll play devil's advocate just because, right? So I agree with what Rebecca said, but I'd say in some ways, I'm already kind of employing it as a screening tool right now. Whenever I get a chance to bring up uveitis, I do. And I'll say that a lot of my patients are terribly, don't dilate at all, right? And so I feel an Optos image in those patients oftentimes sees more than I can see, you know, through their tiny pupil. And I tend to trust it a fair amount. I'd say the other thing to think about is for our routine injection patients, how often are we truly doing a thorough peripheral examination rather than maybe a macular examination or perfusion examination, you know, post-injection or right before injection. So I think if you were to poll all retina specialists, seeing a return injection patient, I'd say a photo might be giving you more than you might get actually from a quick peek in their eye after or before their injection. But I completely agree with Rebecca. It does not replace what I would consider a full dilated exam in a retina clinic.
Yeah, great points by both of you. I think it is fascinating because it is already sort of happening. I think that a lot of us utilize it and the technology is fantastic. I don't think there's anyone listening to this who should be saying that wide field imaging has no place in the retina clinic. I think we've all sort of accepted the benefits. It allows us, you said, Akshay, in some of these patients who don't dilate very well, or you have a lot of capsular phimosis or problems tolerating the exam, allows you to see what's going on in the retinal periphery. Rebecca, to your point, pediatric patients, for example, some of these really difficult patients, it's super helpful. I think the interesting question comes, though. I think there's kind of three interesting questions, and I'll throw back to Rebecca in a sec to get your thoughts. I mean, I think issue number one is short term, you start getting this imaging, right? There are problems sometimes, right? There's going to be artifacts. There's going to be things that are, for example, by an optometrist, an ophthalmologist, are deemed as lesions. We've all seen this. And then they're referred urgently to a retina clinic. And probably it's better safe than sorry. That's what we always tell the patients. But do you create, it's almost like MRIs seeing incidentalomas, right? That weren't seen 20 or 30 years ago. Do you start capturing things that wouldn't have been captured in the exam that aren't important? What's the number of patients you save with an Optos versus the number of patients who get referred? It's an interesting systems question because it comes down to costs and how you think the system should utilize screening tools. That's not, to me, as pressing as the second or third issue. I think the second issue is long-term. How does education change, right? So how do you teach people the skill set to do the exam when they have to do it, right? So I think for someone, I don't think it's use it or lose it. I actually think it's more like riding a bicycle to do a good dilated and depressed exam. So Akshay Thomas did a ton of those as a fellow. If he's not doing them routinely in every patient, but he needs to break it out on call when the Optos is broken or when he has a patient who, you know, is in an office where he doesn't have the machine, he can do it. I have no doubts that he could do it. But for, I think of this with our residents, right? They're getting more and more Optos imaging. It's great that they're utilizing the technology, but if you become dependent on it and you never develop the skill set to do that exam and the tricks and tools to do an exam when you don't have the imaging, there is a problem there. And that ties into problem number three is if you see stuff, you have to treat it sometimes. And right, we've all had this where Optos captures something and now you have to treat it. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing because before you wouldn't have seen it at all maybe on your exam. And it would have caused an RD, or I'm thinking of a tear that's in the periphery or a small hole. But now you've captured something that you can't treat for whatever reason on exam. Let's say it's not your skill set, or let's say it's just not possible. Maybe the optos just makes it look way easier, and there's something about the mechanics that make it not possible. We don't really have data on what the next step is. I think most of us would say, okay, peripheral RD, can't barricade it or laser it. Okay, that patient's going to surgery. But we don't have great data on peripheral tears. You know, Norm Beyer had data from back in the day about what do you do with those tears and you barricade them. I think a lot of people would say, okay, it's a peripheral break. If they're asymptomatic, watch it. If they're symptomatic and there's fluid, maybe take them to surgery if you can't laser it. But the truth is, we don't even know if these things were included in those studies, because who knows if this is what they were seeing on those exams, right? I'm not talking about your routine 8-millimeter pupil. I'm talking about your 3-millimeter pupil or your K-Pro patient who now you get an optos and there's something funky in the periphery. No one else would have seen that before. I don't care how good a retina specialist, I don't care if it was Harvey Linkoff looking for it. He was not going to see it, right? But now you can see it. We don't have data on whether or not those lesions should be treated. And now you end up in a binary scenario, which is I either watch this thing with serial optos images, or I take a patient to surgery who otherwise would not have needed something. These are the things I think about, Rebecca, when I think about an article like this. And any thoughts on any of those three things? I mean, education, treatment of things that you see, or even the idea, again, of just over referrals?
Yeah, I think your last point is particularly salient. I had a patient in clinic who had terrible capsular phimosis and came in with flashes and floaters. And, you know, I did get imaging on it. But even then, when you're doing a depressed exam, you know, you're like, how am I going to treat something if I actually find it? And to your point, you know, then you potentially put someone at risk for over-treating or over-surgerizing someone if you find something on optos. Then again, at the same time, you know, I think to your point, Akshay, using it for routine kind of AMD patients or routine diabetics, I mean, I honestly think just monitoring someone from episode to episode, it's probably honestly a better exam, because you can actually look, you know, exactly side by side and say, was that here before? You know, are they actually regressing? You know, sometimes I feel like the calling something like regressing PDR is such a hand wavy thing to do. And with optos, you can actually call it that, you know, especially with those very peripheral NVE lesions. So to your point, I think that's very well said. Some patients, it's actually very worth monitoring on optos.
Akshay, what do you think?
I mean, I agree. I think, you know, I certainly think during training, it shouldn't be, you know, a crutch that you kind of rely on. I think you absolutely need to build your skills. But I would say that, you know, in practice, I don't think of it as a sign of weakness, right? I don't feel, you know, kind of, you know, shy about getting a photo. There's more than one case in which I feel like I've seen a tiny break on an optos, and they go into this in the article, how your peripheral retina is kind of artificially expanded in these images. And it's like, whoa, look at this huge break. And I'm looking at that quadrant for a long time with depression. I just can't find it. And sometimes use the optos really to show me landmarks for where the tear is and where to treat it. I feel like it's a useful tool to have, and it's available, and we should use it.
Yeah, I think the last thing, which you guys both know, but I think most people know, I think the other thing you think about with optos, and this is true of any imaging, is if you get it, you got to look at the images, and it's just like OCT. And I still see cases from this from time to time, people taking optos routinely and it's interpreted as normal. Maybe they were getting it from one eye, but they got both. And you see something in the other eye that was never discussed, never even probably noticed. And that is just a recipe for lawsuits when you have a documented issue. That's not a reason, you know, I had an attending years ago, little salty, little bit more experienced, who said, but this is why you don't get imaging, because if you get imaging, that will burn you. I don't believe in that. I think you should still get the imaging, but you do need to look at it, especially generally, unless you teach your technicians or photographers, they're going to capture both eyes unless you specify. This ties into speaking of clinic flow. There's another article about big data and data analytics in retina. Elise Tom and Sabin Dang wrote this with the subtitle "New Tools Benefit Practice Management and Patient Care," and this goes into what they do at the Retina Institute in St. Louis. And they talk a little bit about how they use Nextech, which is a cloud-based EHR, and how the EHR captures many, many different things. It also combines with their billing, and that allows them to do big data sort of analyses. And they use Tableau, which is an analytics platform, and then it can take a large data set and allow them to break it down very, very quickly. They talk about usually the ability of this was sort of reserved for bigger companies, but it's become easier and easier. There's more and more tools to sort of do these analysis. And this is a great article for anyone who's interested in kind of doing big data studies. I think this is a reasonable article to start with because it goes through the reasons why this may be important. And it talks about the different sort of things that are done. You know, I've had med students ask me about doing big data studies. Well, IRIS registry is discussed here, which again is one of the biggest specialty society clinical data registries in medicine and the biggest one in ophthalmology. And then there are companies such as insurance companies or other companies that may provide data for big data type studies. They talk finally is kind of the take home point. They use this data to improve practice functioning, right? So they give an example about how they applied Lean and Six Sigma and they reduced patient flow times by 18%. And they can use like models and data simulation models using their existing data to do this. Rebecca, you've done a couple of bigger data type analyses. Did this speak to your heart? Any comments on this article?
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading this article. I think something that this article really brought to my attention was kind of the difference between real world analytics, which is what big data has sort of brought to us through the IRIS registry, and essentially what they do in at their practice, which I would call maybe more like real time analytics. So it's really that they talk about in the beginning, but big data is essentially three V's. It's velocity, volume, and I forget what the third one was, but regardless, I think the velocity is just ever increasing, and they're showing the use of the software in their real clinical practice, like at, you know, in practice, you know, trying to figure out when patients can come, you know, if there's a snowstorm, you know, who's going to show up, what clinics should they close, their staffing issues, things like that. And I think that's just the way of the future. I mean, I can't wait for us to really be able to use data sources like the IRIS registry on an even faster time scale. And I think that's just down the road where really we can say, hey, look, you know, this growing population has a huge rate of, you know, diabetes and tractional retinal detachments. You know, we need to open up OR access for this particular population. I think it's just such a, it's just the way of the future, I think.
Akshay, do anything to poke holes in? I mean, it all sounds great. I agree with Beck. That's very promising. I don't really see any disadvantages. I guess the only thing you can comment on is maybe we have to keep in mind the limitations of big data studies as we go forward in the future, if more and more of these studies come out. And I guess for analyzing your practice.
Yeah, I think so. I think obviously, as you guys know, there are limitations to data sets like the IRIS registry, where we have finite variables and really don't have access to the raw data, more so just the analyses you asked for. But I think it's very interesting from how Subin looked at it more just from their own practice, just like Rebecca was saying, how to kind of improve outcomes for their patients, looking where to put doctors, where the need is, when to close clinics. I think those are more just like day-to-day kind of aspects of clinic flow and clinic function that I honestly didn't think about, you know, using big data for that. We usually kind of think about it and looking at thousands and thousands of patients to look at, you know, what are predictors of AMD outcomes or something like that. Whereas here we're looking at what's going to make a patient come or not come to an appointment, which is probably equally as important. So hats off to Sabin.
No, this ties a little bit into the next article, which is home monitoring for neovascular AMD conversion, with subtitle trends are taking shape that could change retina care. But I should check in. And again, the same idea that there are things that are on the horizon. We've discussed home monitoring a bit, and I think that's worth reading. He references other piece from Retinal Physician by Miguel Busquets. I think that the big take home here from Sid is that we're probably underutilizing home monitoring for AMD. And one of the reasons it's probably underutilized is it still results in folks, most of us don't do PRN for our treatment intervals, right? So it's really just there as a rescue capture for the people using it. It's not to dictate when care should be given. And there's also the economics of it. I think that's, and you guys can both talk within your individual practices if anyone does use it or why you don't use it. But I think that's another reason, at least in an academic setting, I see not that many people adopt it. One of the things, though, that ties into the future, big data, is the idea, could you use AI, right? So AI could be connected to this where the physician doesn't have to review it, but you have an artificial intelligence that reviews this data passively as it comes in and spits out results and triggers alerts, right? No different than your car sends a beeper sensor when you get too close to the curb behind you as you reverse, there could be some sort of sensor that indicates to the patient and the physician that something needs to be done. And I think the CID is trying to think forward and move forward in terms of this. It's a great review if you want to read about some of the data on 4C Home. Akshay, if you're thinking ahead, or let's look back first before we think ahead, do you use this in your practice? Does anyone use it? And if not, what are the barriers for utilization?
So no, I don't. And I don't believe anyone in my practice does either. I think probably the biggest barrier to utilization is kind of what some of the data that Sid actually pointed out in this article, which was that, you know, in this Loft study, about it captured about 50% of conversion, and about 50% were captured during the other 50% were captured during routine in-clinic visits, right? And then if you were to have a comparator study where they did kind of, you know, aggressive AMSLR monitoring, that captured about two-thirds of conversion, right? So I guess I maybe for one just don't see the superiority over an AMSLR. And also I think we just kind of know, I don't know, sometimes you just have patients that are extremely motivated and they're monitoring their AMSLR like a hawk. And I feel like those are the ones that are also going to use the 4C Home. And I just feel like they're the ones that might catch stuff on their AMSLR to begin with. And we have other patients that just never monitor their AMSLR and probably won't use equipment that you give them. So I think, and at least as far as it stands currently for home-based monitoring, I don't provide. I think we can discuss home-based OCT if and when that's available. And that I probably have a different answer to that.
Rebecca, what about you? Does anyone at OCB use it?
There was one physician who used to use it. So it was actually the first time I was even ever introduced to the technology as one of our comprehensive docs. But I totally agree. I'm not sure that I find it that much more useful than the AMSLR grid for the reasons that you mentioned, Akshay. And the other thing is, I think the hard part with all of this is the connection between a patient finding a trigger on their AMSLR grid or on the 4C and then actually presenting to clinic. And there are a lot of barriers, you know, both cost, time, economic, distance, things like that from the patient noticing that there's a problem and then presenting. And while I do think it is a little more motivating if someone calls you to tell you, hey, there's a problem, there's still that barrier. And so if we're talking about the utility of this, I think the biggest utility is in the population who, you know, might convert to wet AMD, but then do you give it to all of your intermediate AMD patients? And if so, then I just feel like that's such a huge expense for the healthcare system to give this very, you know, expensive device with an in-person monitoring system. You know, I think probably the most public health thing to say is that an AMSLR grid is actually the most effective thing to give, because you're trying to reach a large population of intermediate AMD patients who are going to convert.
Yeah.
And the ones who will show up to clinic are still the ones who are going to show up to clinic.
Yeah. I think the final thing is, I'm just thinking about other diseases we see. Like, we see patients with diabetes, they can inject, if they sense that their sugar is high or they have a monitor telling them their sugar is high, they can inject themselves or even have a pump, right? Mm-hmm. These patients can't do anything at home. So the barrier is still the coming in. And the barrier to that is still, you would have to and most clinics accommodate these patients, but really, if you're thinking from a systems perspective, you would need to have some sort of built in clinic space for these patients, right? Saying, hey, our 4C Home add-ons come at this time. Because we were just talking about, you know, lean clinic flow in Six Sigma and all these things, Akshay. And that shouldn't be the biggest priority as physicians. The biggest priority should be taking care of individual patients and making sure they can see and keep their vision. But you try to balance these things. It's really hard to run a lean clinic when you have random add-ons. Now, we all get random add-ons, but usually you schedule them in some sort of time. Then you have to worry about insurance approval. If they're not Medicare in the future, are they injection? Are you clear? Do you have the drug in stock? Do you got it from compounding pharmacy? It's just not ideal, versus if down the line there's some sort of treatment patients can give themselves at home, then maybe this becomes more applicable.
I completely agree. And I think you're also thinking about how much you're kind of worrying patients, because on the one hand, if you're like, here's this piece of equipment and we should really kind of follow whatever it tells us. And then they get some alert and they're like, okay, well, we can get you to clinic in 2 days. They're going to be like, what? They're like, what are we talking about? You just told me this is so critical that even if I don't notice a change in my vision, but this piece of equipment says I might have a change, I need to be seen immediately. And then, you know, so yeah, so I agree. I think it's You know, it can sometimes cause a little more. And sometimes you pull a patient and you're like, well, actually, just detected this little, you know, tiny PED that collapsed, and you actually don't have any conversion. They're like, well, that's the last time I'm going to come in after getting an alert from this system, right? So I don't know. I think it's a balance.
I totally agree. I think, and I also think the number of false positives that you get also sort of depends on your like definition of when someone converted. And I think what's interesting is that if you use this in, if you are doing like a PRN treatment, which I think most of us do treat and extend, if you are doing sort of a PRN treatment protocol and you're using this for patients, not just people who converted, but patients who have wet AMD who you want to bring back into the clinic, what fluid definition are you using? Some people tolerate SRF. Some people, you know, they think that no fluid should be in the macula whatsoever. And they just came out with a, you know, a recent study in retina looking at that number of fluid-free visits. And then, you know, how are you programming this device to then notify you when there's fluid? Is it when there's just IRF or when there's IRF and SRF? So it's just an interesting, it just brings a lot of false positives into the clinic, I think, which is not necessarily cost effective for anybody.
Well, let's tie that into the last article, which is an update on stem cell therapy for retinal diseases. Samuel Fellman, Glenn Yu, and Susanna Park wrote this with the subtitle, Current Clinical Trials Show Promise for a Variety of Conditions. And again, great review for anyone who wants to read about what stem cells mean. They talk about that, and they talk about how there are different types. There are obviously human embryonic stem cells or induced pluripotent stem cells. They talk about a good summary table here of all the trials that are sort of ongoing. And we get questions from patients all the time about this. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I get a question at least once a week from someone asking about stem cells. And they heard from someone, there's this clinic in Mexico or there's this clinic in, you know, X country. They can go get stem cell therapy. But in terms of where these trials are at, the furthest along any trial is the JCITE trial, which is a phase 2B double mask, which is complete. But we don't have a phase 3 stem cell trial, at least right now. It's ongoing. So they end by talking about this. I think it's one of the biggest take-home points is, you know, Ajay Kurian's published this. Other people have published on so-called stem cell therapy centers. There's a lot of unregulation of what you can do. I think the FDA has cracked down a little bit more in recent years, but some of these clinics still exist. So I think that the biggest thing is in the future, Rebecca, you were just talking about costs. A lot of it's going to be dictated by costs in terms of applying stem cell therapy to a broader audience, right? I mean, there's a whole host of patients who could benefit. Dystrophy patients, macular degeneration patients, trauma patients who were young and had some retinal trauma. RP has been brought up. And then you have all your diabetics who may have ischemia or other issues. Rebecca, when you think about stem cell therapy and think about the questions you get in clinic, I mean, it feels like we've sort of been stuck in stasis, because I feel like I've been in practice 7 years and I feel still giving patients the same answer I gave them 5 to 6 years ago, which is maybe in 5 to 10 years we'll have something. This seems to give me more hope after I read this that there may be something down the line, at least something that works, and then we'll see if it can translate to a product that works on the market.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was a good summary of kind of what is out there and what's coming down the pipeline. I think the thing that seems most tangible to me is they kind of make a distinction between, you know, the embryonic stem cells and the induced pluripotent stem cells, which have the goal of tissue replacement. And then the goal of tissue repair, they mention, is through multipotent stem cells. So things like CD4 cells, mesenchymal stem cells. And because you're utilizing the trophic effects of those multipotent stem cells, you can do intravitreal injection as your mode of delivery. And to me, that seems like the most tangible and feasible to implement in current practice the way that it is. What's hard about a lot of these upcoming gene therapies and stem cell therapies is they rely very heavily on time in the OR, which if we are to transition to, you know, a future where patients have one treatment in the OR and then the stem cell or gene therapy just continues kind of for the rest of their lives, it's going to be a huge transition in the field of retina to require every AMD patient with geographic atrophy to undergo an operation in the operating room. And so I think that the thing that is most tangible to me right now is the multipotent stem cell treatment, where you could potentially give it through intravitreal injection. That seems the most cost-effective and most reasonable within the time frame, you know, within the near future, the way our clinics are set up.
Akshay, comments?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned this in one of our other episodes. I mean, whether we're talking about stem cells or gene therapy or optogenetics, I think, you know, I think it's important for all of us to kind of have a basic understanding of what these are. So when our patients ask about things, we can give a somewhat intelligible answer. And if a trial is ongoing, we need to kind of be aware of it for patients that, I mean, a lot of times patients with retinal dystrophies are not being seen by a ocular geneticist, they're being seen by a retina specialist. And I think we just need to be aware of what studies are going on and which are legit. But also, with regards to the quote unquote stem cell clinics, I mean, I'd call them more like stem cell spas, because my patients have told me that they will fly you there and you know, house you in a 5-star hotel and feed you and you get your stem cells and then you go home. So I don't know, it's kind of crazy, but I agree that it's amazing how many patients seem very motivated, you know, not even for conditions which are not treatable. I'd say I have a decent number of patients who are like, instead of getting the shot, can I get some stem cells? And I'm like, oh, dude, it's amazing how much it's like people are just like, oh yeah, sure, I'll give me some of those if it'll take care of my problems. I won't have to keep getting these injections. So who knows?
Yeah, I think that the problem, I think one of the things that we have to think about, and we do our individual counseling, but I do think as a field, it would almost be helpful if we had Q3 to 6, like patients could sign up for some sort of newsletter or something, or the family members, and we could give them some sort of official every Q3 to 6 month updates, right? Something to hang their hat on to say, hey, you know, this trial is X point, and here's a percentage about how far along it is, and here's your anticipated timeline. Like, no promises, but I think the biggest reason actually people end up asking the questions, and then going to one of these things is not because they're disobeying doctors, because they're desperate. And they don't get the answers they need, and they don't find the answers they want when they look it up. And so I do think that if you could give people something to hang their hat on, that would probably go a long way towards preventing utilization. Because the folks who are choosing to use these clinics are generally not bad people. There are people who have decided that they want to pour their resources into their health. They're not even the wealthiest people sometimes, but they just decided that is everything they're going to pour into this one cup. So I almost wonder, I'm not an organizational expert, but I almost wonder if this would be the sort of thing to take a leadership role and say, hey, patients, if you sign up here, physicians could give their patients, hey, if you sign up for this newsletter, you know, every 2 to 3 months, you're getting an update on stem cells or other trials that come out. I think some individual groups will do that for patients. I don't think it's super common. I know both of you guys do trials at your practices, but I don't know how much we do in terms of updating these patients, because there are a substantial number of patients and families who want to be in the know about what's going on.
I definitely agree. I think it behooves us as a group to really market, you know, clinical trials that are going down the FDA approved path for patients. I was very interested in this article because I really hadn't heard, I knew that there were stem cell clinics, but I didn't really know that much about them. And
they're all in Florida. No, I'm kidding. A lot of them are in Florida.
What baffles me and what I had to do a little more research about was how they have gotten past the FDA for so long. And it sounds like that in 2019, the FDA won its first case against the big stem cell company in Florida that gave the intravitreal injection of stem cells that blinded people. But I thought what the scariest part about it was, I was reading an article by the New York Times about it, and it said essentially that even though the FDA now has regulatory ability and precedent to kind of be the regulatory body of these stem cell centers, that most stem cell centers will continue practicing until the FDA really actually begins to formally file a complaint against them. So I think it's just interesting that these, I'm sure that, you know, having a losing a trial for the stem cell center companies was very negative marketing for them, but they're still out there and they're still going to be out there until the FDA literally comes to knock on their door. So I think it behooves us as physicians to really, you know, help patients feel cared for, help them feel like they have options within the traditional medical field, and then also help market, you know, what are good clinical trials and what are not.
Yeah, and to your point, there was a big article in BBC. I don't know if you guys saw this. It was in March 16th of this year, And his title was The Doctors Selling Bogus Treatments for People Facing Blindness. So it was written by Ramadan Yunus, who is a young guy who was diagnosed with RP. And so he's a reporter as well. And he's gone around the world kind of looking for treatments, but also evaluating things. And he talks about all the different places he's seen sort of this miracle cure has been offered to him. And one of them was in Miami. Unfortunately, Florida, like I said, is the home of a lot of things that are sort of, depending on whose side you're on, some people call it the cutting edge. I think most of us call it the brink of immorality in medicine, or totally over that line. And he talks about, you know, he went through this process where patients have to pay $20,000 to take part in this stem cell trial with Dr. Jeffrey Weiss and Dr. Stephen Levy. And he says he pretended to be a patient and recorded everything secretly to find out more. And basically what they would do is take bone marrow stem cells and inject them under the eyelids and into the orbit in order to cure their retinitis pigmentosa. And that he was told they had treated over 700 patients, and the vast majority of patients had experienced benefit. But, you know, there have been some of these patients have gone on social media and have been like, no, don't do this because I did it and I can see worse than I did before. So he gets along the process. They quoted two of my colleagues here, Dr. Albini and Dr. Lamb. Dr. Lamb, this is classics, called these claims really crazy. Dr. Albini said, it's extremely difficult for me to believe there were zero adverse events. So he eventually told them that he was a reporter, and the doctor running the trial told him, and I'll quote this, it's just a good quote, "Your self-serving desire for a tiny flicker of fame through harming our study remains unbound. You are a disgrace to your family and to millions of people suffering from untreatable eye disease across the world." But the point is that this still is going on, to your point, Rebecca. It's not like anyone's gone in there and shut this place down or other places like it. So it's good that there's more sort of communication in the media that this exists. And I think, to your point, we just need to get stories about these places out there. Otherwise, they end up with a doctor like this instead of a nice, kind doctor like Dr. Akshay Thomas.
Thanks, Jay.
I've heard he can cure uveitis on sight if he just looks at you for long enough.
Oh, God.
That and methotrexate. It's a combo.
That's right. That's right. Just put it in the water. We'll all be fine.
All right. Well, thank you guys for your time. That will conclude our preview of the 2023 May edition of Retinal Physician. Again, you can find that online. And Rebecca Suarez, Russ Suarez, and Akshay Thomas, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jay.
Many thanks to Dr. Suarez and Thomas for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember, you can find us on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. Remember that all of our episodes, there's 389 of them, can be found there and sorted by category. You can find us in the podcast app on your favorite mobile device. That's either the Apple Podcast or Android Podcast app. We're also working on getting added to Spotify. Shout out to Dr. Nick Farber for that suggestion. Remember, listeners, you can find us on our website to give us feedback by clicking on the contact us link on our website or by emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to our whole production team. That includes Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benincasa. Listeners, thank you for listening. Thank you for what you do on a daily basis. Thank you for the patients you take care of and for the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schrader signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.